From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, a conversation with two Utah poets about their new collections. Jacqueline Oshiro and Paisley Rekdal will join us. Both books have themes to them, common strands. Oshiro filtering her experiences through her Jewish identity, Rekdal riffing on and reworking the myths of Ovid, but the poems are also different and surprising and funny and disturbing. It was hard to know where to start, but we managed. We'll be right back.
My name is Daisha Eaton. I am a reporter covering religion and social justice for KUER. I became interested in public radio because I realized in listening how powerful it is to hear someone else's story through their voice. It is beyond anything you can do through the written word.
Help KUER bring the stories that matter to your state. Make a contribution today at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Two conversations today with two Utah poets. Jacqueline Oshiro and Paisley Rekdal have new collections. Most of Oshiro's poems came from her experiences traveling, places that were unfamiliar at first or made her feel uneasy. But over time, she usually lets time pass before she begins to write about something she noticed. Over time, she has something to say about the Jewish cemetery in Morocco or the linden trees in Germany or a place imagined, like a woman who supposedly looks exactly like her in Nepal. In fact, that's the title piece in her book called My Lookalike at the Krishna Temple. Jacqueline Oshiro is a distinguished professor of English and creative writing at the University of Utah.
How does a collection begin? Is it, oh, I've got enough, let's go, or is there something, I mean, because clearly there's a theme, and we'll talk about,
yeah.
Or at least I think you're getting at a theme.
It began to dawn on me that I was writing a number of poems in which I was looking at features of other religions. But really using them as a way to re-examine my relationship to my own religion. I don't think I realized that immediately. And, you know, the title poem, I call it a found poem in that this really did happen.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I really was told that there's a woman who looks just like me in Nepal worshiping with this guy's mother at the Krishna temple. And I must tell you, the idea, I mean, no one can see me, but you really couldn't look more like an Eastern European Jew than
right,
I do.
Right.
And the idea that someone who looks like me is worshiping in the Krishna temple really blew my mind. So, you know, but there again, what do I know about Hindu worship? Very, very little. A little more from having written this poem. But so I did start to notice that I was doing that. But then at the same time, I had been told what I considered an astonishing fact. That the Alhambra, you know, this building that was largely constructed between 11th and 14th century, had all, there were exactly 17 kinds of two-dimensional symmetry, all of which were represented there. I found this an extraordinarily interesting fact and thought it would make for very interesting poetry. So that was yet another idea that I wanted to pursue that took, of course, a very, very long time, as it's a very, very long series of poems. So a bunch of things at once. I am not one of these people who says I have a book project and then I go and fulfill my book project. I write one thing at a time,
yeah.
Pretty much. Yeah.
One thing you've also said, this was interesting, is that maybe it's not such a great idea to write about a place when you're there.
Oh, this is absolutely true.
Well, so hold on, let me just wait a while and figure out what those impressions meant, because they're not the same thing.
Exactly. I think if you write about the place you're in, you're condemned, perhaps, to write about what's in front of your face.
Yeah.
Whereas when you write about a place after you've left, it's what's left with you, the thing that made the greatest impression on you, the thing you can't get out of your head that you're going to write about. I could talk about this in lots of specific instances if you'd like, but none, I mean, these Fez poems were written in Salt Lake City. They were not written in Fez. The Alhambra, some of it was written in Montana. So, you know, we have, you know, so, I mean, what can I tell you? None of it was written where I talked about it. I suppose Spring Comes Late to Salt Lake City was indeed written in Salt Lake City, but It took a long, long time. It was probably finished in winter.
Yeah. Well, we'll come back to that one because I want to, because it is spring in Salt Lake City.
There you go. Almost.
We're getting there. You're right. It's not quite. Yeah. It doesn't seem right. But
well, no, it feels like
it. It does kind of, right?
I have daffodils.
Okay, good. So do we. Okay, this trip to Morocco, you visited the old part of town and a Jewish cemetery there.
Yeah.
Just say something about that. I wonder what you were thinking about. To me, the thing that I have to say that stayed with me was that clacking sound.
Oh, I'm so glad.
Yeah.
Because, you know, first of all, my daughter speaks Arabic. And she brought me around Morocco. She knew that in Arabic, stork is lak lak. And in other words, an onomatopoetic name. I mean, this is what they sound like, clack, 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 clack. And that's the only sound. They don't have a coo. They don't have a call. They just have clacking, those enormous bills. So the sound is everywhere. I'm glad the clacking sound remains with you because pretty much every stanza has an ack sound, a clacking sound. I really wanted that to be the prevailing sound of the poem. And I do have nostalgia for my typewriter. I assure you, anything I wrote on a typewriter was an absolute mess, white out, whatever. But that sound, you know, I miss it when I'm writing, you know. And so eventually the clack, clack, lock, lock led to the sound of the typewriter. So it kind of got there.
Will you read that poem?
Oh, sure, sure. The stork in the heavens revisited. Through the bursting Medina's jumbled alleyways, the local farmers pull their donkey carts, the lion's share piled high with mint, while others flaunt cherries, potatoes, carrots, and a belated one or two glisten with artichokes, whose wild cousins in the open fields have already gone to purple flower. I find them in the cemetery near the beauty's grave. She wouldn't convert to Islam for the prince. It's still well kept, the Jewish cemetery of Fez, though not too many mourners will return. And high above it, if only I could crack their code, these gliding black and white inscriptions, circling and circling, Morocco's storks, some coasting, others on the prowl. They're lock lock in Arabic for the sounds they make, clacking bills. They have no call. Each cluster of nests, storks prefer to nest in packs, a cheerfully percussive ruckus, whether they're crammed together on the ancient walls of Shella or balanced one by one atop the columns of Volubilis, their inhabitants eavesdropping on Orpheus's lyre as he beguiles a neighborhood menagerie, monkey, elephant, oryx, leopard, peacock, decked out in opulent mosaic, or on a multi-level metal tower for power lines, like the one out the window of my bus from Meknes, on every level an extended arm, on every arm another nest. Oh, my insatiable, oblivious storks, how you put our human triumphs in perspective. Our habitual failure to hold on to things, each epoch's offering state of the art or rubble, an occasion for a colony of clacking nests. And I have to wonder, here in the Jewish cemetery of Fez, whose handiwork we're ignoring in our deafening, oblivious colonies. Who's out there trying to decode our own equivocal inscriptions, from stone hieroglyphs to ink on parchment to LED lights on a screen, through all our interim contingencies, from my first transcriptions, from those fly-by-night contraptions for which I'm sometimes so nostalgic, my grandfather's enormous black Underwood, my sleek little Lettera 32, pages hardly perfect, flecked with whiteout, smudged, messy, but we always sounded so supremely purposeful. Clack, 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 clack.
It's great.
Thank you.
Tilia Cordata, the poem. It begins with you taking in the fragrance from the linden trees. It's the last part of June. But then you encounter that same fragrance in Berlin.
Well, actually, in this poem, I was in Darmstadt.
Okay. But it throws you off. It throws you off to encounter this fragrance. And as you say, how could this place have anything in common with your home? Talk a little bit about this poem, where it comes from.
Oh, well, I was in Darmstadt for a completely other reason, to look at Art Nouveau, which I talked about in my last book. But it was my first time in Germany.
Yeah.
And as the poem makes clear, I have, you know, I think it's just a product of when I was born and who I am. Born in 1956, not very long after the war, to Jewish parents who, I think like all the world's Jews, felt very guilty that they were still alive, you know, and sort of horrified by what had taken place. And really, they didn't think about what they were letting their children hear about and know about and see. I mean, we saw these movies when I was very little in Hebrew school, movies like Night and Fog. And so
you didn't dare take a shower until you were seven.
Yeah, that's an actual fact.
Yeah.
My mother had said, as I say in the poem, my mother had said, you know, I overheard and I said, what is this? I was very pushy child. When I wanted to know something, I wouldn't give up. And I think she finally said, well, you know, really very unhappily telling me this. Well, there were people who went to a place and they went to take showers and instead of water, gas came out. That's what she said. Well, I, of course, assumed that the showers were broken. Showers were very dangerous and that gas could come out of them. And I didn't want to take any chances.
Right.
And I really didn't. I remember when my mother finally asked me, why on earth will you take a shower? It would be so much easier to wash your hair. I had this thick, curly hair. You know, and I said, I finally admitted that I was afraid gas would come out. You can imagine her horror. But yes, so I think that pretty much makes clear how inundated I am and was as a child with these realities of what had happened, you know, 11 years before my birth. And so Germany was a difficult place for me to be in. And the German language to me—
Made you feel perpetually uneasy, is how you put it.
Indeed.
Yeah.
I mean, I really had a very difficult time just hearing it.
Yeah.
Because to me, it's this, you know, it was. I've forced myself to do things a little differently in the last few years because of this poem. And but it really sounded like Nazis to me. That's all it sounded like.
Mm.
And so I was very unhappy to be there. And so it was extremely strange to suddenly realize that I was smelling one of my favorite smells on earth, that it smelled just like my home. Even before that, because it's lush city parks, really in every city I've been in Germany, and now I've been in a few more, notably Berlin. And they have huge amounts of greenness. There's huge parks in any German city, like my hometown, Philadelphia, which we were told had the largest city park in the world. But when I was a child, I don't know what it's like now, but I mean, whether somebody has a bigger park, but Philly has a huge city park system. And my father had grown up near our biggest, the great Fairmount Park, and would take me there all the time when I was a child. So I was very much reminded of my father as a young man and myself as a tiny kid. And it was just extremely strange to be in Germany and reminded of my childhood. So both homes, Philadelphia and now the home I live in now, Salt Lake, it was very, very strange and disconcerting.
The poem wonders if, as you put it, every good thing has its measure of imperfection lurking in the wings. So there's that pleasant fragrance, but then there's, something maybe insidious behind all of those things?
Well, I mean, as I say in the poem, it's impossible that people who were being herded onto trains didn't smell this smell. It's all over Europe at a certain time. They were herding people into trains all the time. And so the idea that that smell should now be associated in my mind with something horrible brought me to this thought that, you know, nothing's untouched by horror. I mean, on this imperfect earth of ours. I mean, what can you say?
Yeah. One of the things you've been, we've talked about this before, and you're pretty adamant about it, that you don't make stuff up.
Yeah, I really don't.
It's like this stuff is real.
I always say I write creative nonfiction.
Yeah, that's right. So when someone tells you, you're at a restaurant in Salt Lake City and someone tells you that you have a lookalike, as you were talking about before, in Nepal, And this was the found poem that you come up with, and it's the title poem in the piece. Talk a little bit about the woman you're imagining.
Well, right. Now. Of course, this is completely imaginary.
Absolutely. And you don't know her name, by the way.
I know, which really drove me crazy because right. I kept asking him. I go, this was Kathmandu. I understand he has another restaurant. Yeah. Now I'm going to go find him and give him a book. But this was at Kathmandu. And I went a lot. It's near my house. And I like the food.
Yeah.
And I would go and say, hi, Gopal, how are you doing? Did you find out that woman's name? I mean, I did this for a while.
Yeah.
It just wasn't happening. And I think I would have had a very different poem if I had a name.
Hmm.
But not having a name, I had to make things up. And, of course, he had made a point of, not your clothing. She wears saris. Yeah. So that was why. So I started, you know, hallucinating, really, I would say, about these fabulous saris that my lookalike wore. I am not much of a dresser, I have to tell you. So it was really, I was creating a real opposite, as you might imagine.
Yeah.
But also I was doing this and making her very devout, going every day to the temple.
More focused than you are.
Much more focused than I am. Though I am, as I say in the poem, quite focused when I chant. But other than that, I'm a fairly bad attendant, glared out constantly by the rabbi for not shutting up in the back seat. I actually knew, and I put this in the poem later, but I have Hindu friends who had come to my daughter's baby naming and loved synagogue because they said it was exactly like Hindu temple because nobody pays attention. Everybody just talks to each other, greets their friends, shakes hands. They loved it. You know, they thought it was going to be like church where people behave. Right. I said, what are you kidding? Have you not met us? We don't behave. You know, so I really knew even as I was imagining this Krishna temple. Or maybe I remembered later as I was putting the poem together, wait a minute. Krishna temple's not like that. You know, you're making this up. But of course, I knew nothing, so I could make everything up. And it's fun. So it's when I say ideal, I don't make things up that I say happened.
Yes.
But I speculate all the time about the stuff
I know
nothing about. So
yeah.
I suppose I make one or two things up.
I want to ask about Backyard Meteor.
Oh.
So if it's not good to write about a poem when you're there in a place— that it's more interesting to see what impressions shake out eventually. Is that also true of an experience?
Well, you know, Wordsworth famously says, poetry is emotion recollected in tranquility.
Yeah.
And I have to say, in all honesty, I was not all that tranquil. I started this, it says so. It was the spring. This young woman died in the beginning of December. It wasn't that long after.
Let's just make it clear. This is a daughter's friend.
Yes,
who took
her own life. Yeah. Which was as you might imagine, just such a horrific event. And I was, you know, it was all I had on my mind, frankly. Mm, mm. And really, if you're a poet, that's what you do with things. You know, you put them into poems. Now, it did take a very long time from the draft to sort of trying to get it in such a place that it wasn't, you know, overwhelmed by my own misery.
Mm-hmm.
Because after all, I really do. I think Wordsworth does have a point. You know, a poem takes a little bit of control over that emotion. Mm-hmm. So it took quite a while, I think, till I finally got it in any kind of shape in which I would let anybody see it.
Yeah. We begin in the most ordinary way possible. You're taking
the trash. Yeah.
And you see a meteor.
Again, because I'm not going to. No, I really did.
Yeah.
I believe you. I'm making it up.
Yeah.
And I myself didn't really believe it, but I really saw it.
Yeah,
it was extraordinary. And here you go, as I say in the book, you go up to the mountains, you find the darkest spot on earth. And here in my own backyard in very lit up Salt Lake City, there was this meteor. Because it was close to the Geminids.
Yeah.
And I think that's why I got lucky. But I begin. I'm taking out the trash. That's what I was doing.
Well, you say also that you don't usually see messages in the stars. But in this one, you thought, I'm going to take this as an omen?
Yeah, but that didn't last long.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not one for messages in the stars, though I do love to look at them.
I'm not sure we have time to read all of it, but could you read some of this poem for us?
Backyard Meteor. Now it's spring. And while I do love the morning bird song, those hardy violets that showed up weeks ago with crocuses and early daffodil, toughened by each fresh round of snow, I'm not ready to leave off my daily ritual of willing the earth to spin backwards. Spin backwards, earth, however futile, to just an hour earlier that day. Maybe next time there'll be waiting periods or background checks. Earth, spin backwards. The gun store clerk will just send her away. But all this greenness keeps pressing upwards. Earth only spins a single way. Sometimes in the pathway of a Geminid, like the textbook one I saw the night she died. I remembered it eventually, prompted by a telltale swagger over my garage. And while I'm not one to extort messages from the intrigues of the stars, I was tempted to read it as an omen. She had joined them. Except, of course, that it was heading downward. For some kinds of anguish, there's no balm, no recourse, no deliverance, no sign. But a meteor did flame in my backyard. So intensely bright, it made Orion look pale, even sickly by comparison. Uncertain though it was, and quickly gone.
Let me ask you finally about spring arrives late to Salt Lake City. What to say about it?
What to say about it? Well, you would be amazed at how long it took me to write.
Really?
Yeah, because I wanted to have a few turns. It turns a couple of times, which is not easy to do in 14 lines, but it is a requirement. You know, a sonnet has to turn at least once, but I wanted to turn a couple of times, and it took a very long time. So I'm glad when you're surprised, because one wants to make it seem very off the cuff. But it was hard work, actually. And it is 13th South. As you ride down 13th South, you see all what I was describing there, or at least I thought I saw it.
Great.
Let's just put it that way. Okay. Spring arrives late to Salt Lake City. Why so hesitant, Spring? What's the problem? I've never known you quite this shy. You're like a new girl in junior high, avoiding the hallways, the lunchroom, strangely oblivious of your own beauty, or perhaps afraid of it, keeping it hidden. But what's happening? All of a sudden, you're trying prom dresses on all over the city, absurdly poofy pinks, whites, purple, reds, yards and yards of crinoline beneath each skirt. And now you're tearing them up. Exquisite shreds cover streets, cars, sidewalks, rooftops, grass. You're back to all or nothing, Spring. I'm envious. I aimed to be like that, but I lost heart.
That's Jacqueline Ochereau. She's a distinguished professor of English and creative writing at the University of Utah. Her new collection of poetry is called My Look-Alike at the Krishna Temple. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
Hey there, podcast listener. I'm Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. If you enjoy the show, we'd appreciate it if you did us a little favor. Find us on the iTunes store and leave us a review. Let us know what you think. It's valuable feedback for us, and frankly, the more reviews we have, the more listeners we can attract. Thanks in advance. Thanks for listening, and enjoy the show.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're having conversations with two Utah poets, Jacqueline Ochereau and Paisley Rechdahl, who have new collections. In Rechdahl's book, she's created her own translation of Ovid's Metamorphoses. But as we discuss in the conversation, this is not a translation that you can easily recognize, because she's stripped out the gods and the goddesses, all the paganism, in fact, and some of the gore. It's like she's boiling off the excess, reducing these ancient stories to reveal what it means to be changed by illness or love or by creation. Her book is called Nightingale, and it's due out on May 7th.
So I guess I had a similar question. How does a collection like this begin? Do you think of it in thematic terms? What's the thing that got this started? What got you thinking about this collection first?
It was sort of by accident. I had been playing around with myths, rewriting myths, and I wrote one called Baucis and Philemon, and that showed up in a book called Imaginary Vessels. And it basically retells the story of this couple that love each other just so much, but they have a difficult relationship with their son who sees their marriage as this thing that's kept them apart. But it's a rewriting of this very famous myth from Ovid's Metamorphoses, and I had so much fun writing it. I just thought, oh, this is, I can write characters and plot and dialogue, things that poets don't get to do. So I thought, I'll just do another one. And I did another one, and then another one, another one. And finally I said, let's just admit it, I'm trying to rewrite Ovid's Metamorphoses, which is an absurd proposition. But what I really understood towards the end of the process was I was really writing about change, and more importantly, I think I was writing about the changes that are done to us, because we ourselves can change and we can choose to change, but oftentimes the ways we change are because other people have forced us to change or circumstances have forced us to change. Ovid makes it that the gods force us to change. But when you take out the supernatural, how is it that change gets wrought on us through illness, through personal experiences that we didn't anticipate, through the deaths of those that we love, through the ending of relationships? And once I realized that, I also thought about how is it that we represent change? So suddenly some of the myths that I had rewritten didn't seem as important, because one of the things that takes place in the Metamorphosis is a real fascination with how we represent what has been done to us and how we feel about that. And once I realized it was also about voicelessness and representation and art, suddenly a lot of decisions became really easy for me. Also, because I was following Ovid so closely, I knew how I had to begin and I knew where I needed to end. As somebody who is not a pagan, I couldn't start with calling or invoking the muse, but I could start with a psalm. I could start from a Christian tradition. And I knew I had to end with this very strange poem called Pythagorean, because the end of the Metamorphoses is this long, strange story of Pythagoras telling us, you know, all of his philosophies and his strange ideas around vegetarianism and all sorts of things. So I knew that those were the opening and closing poems, and everything else had to fit in this question about what is change.
Say something about Psalm, if you would. I mean, this is a tree that you encountered?
I live across from this tree,
yeah.
And I'm obsessed with this tree, which is funny because I'm not somebody who is really obsessed with nature in general. But having moved to Utah many years ago, I feel like I've become more and more and more invested in the natural world. And this tree that's right across from my house is something that sometimes blooms and sometimes it doesn't. And it's an apricot tree. Mm-hmm. And when it really blooms, you just – the whole neighborhood comes out and we just mug this tree because there's so much fruit. And when it doesn't happen, there's a real disappointment. Everyone sort of feels it. And for me, this is a poem in a lot of ways about creative wellsprings of imagination, faith itself. Like, why do you hold on to something when you don't know if it's going to turn out into something else, something wonderful? And I think that I went to Catholic school for years, and that was one thing that did get drilled into me, that you believe regardless of any kind of reward at the end. And it's the same thing for the writing of poetry. You write even if you don't think that the poem might turn out to be successful or something you like.
I mean, you write about in this poem the conflicting ideas of having to be patient on one hand and just wanting to eat, right? I mean, you hunger because you're hungry, you say, and the tree calls to this. So there's that part where you should be restrained, and then there's that other part where you just give in, I guess. Are those the ideas that you're interested in?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think part of the creative process itself moves between a kind of wildness and a kind of restraint. You have to tap into something that you're not entirely in control of and even aware that you know, in order to get to some place that's surprising even to yourself. And then you go back and you edit, and you have to be incredibly formally intuitive and thoughtful about your choices.
Would you read Psalm?
The whole thing? It is a bit long.
It is a bit long. Let's try it.
All right. psalm. Too soon, perhaps, for fruit, and the broad branches ice-sheathed early may bear none. But still my neighbor waits with her ladder and sack for something to break, a gold, a lengthening of light. For the greens to burst into something not unlike flame, the pale fruit blushing over weeks through the furred cleft creases, a freckling of blood. Then the hot, sweet scent of August rot, drawing wasps and birds and children through the month. So much abundance, and the only cost, waiting. Looking at the tree, I almost expect the sound of bells, a stone church, sheep and flocks, but no sound of bells, no clarion call. The church is far down in the valley. This tree should be an ancient, revered thing placed at the heart of a temple. Instead, it is on a common lot beside a road, apartment buildings, a dog sleeping in its yard. My neighbor has come here neither as master nor supplicant. She simply plans to fill a plastic sack with whatever she can take, the sweetmeat giving under the press of a thumb, covering what is its true fruit, the little pit, hard and almond brown, that I've scooped out, palmed and planted, to no avail. A better gardener could make demands of such a seed, could train a tree for what desire anticipates. But here the tree grows only for itself. And if it bears no fruit for the killing frost, or if it flowers late because of a too warm winter, what debt am I owed? At whose feet should I lay disappointment? Delight no more comforting nor wounding than hunger. The tree traffics in a singular astonishment, its gold tongues lolling out a song so rich and sweet, the notes are left to rot upon the pavement. Is this the only religion left to us? Not one only of mortification or desire, not one of suffering, succor, not even of pleasure. The juice of summer coils in the cells. It is a faith that may not come to more than waiting. To insist on pleasure alone is a mark of childishness. To believe only in denial, the fool's prerogative. You hunger because you hunger, and the tree calls to this. But the fruit is real. I have eaten it, have plucked and washed and cut the weight, and stewed it with sugar and lemon peel until the gold ran rich and thick into jars. I have spooned it over bread and meat. I have sucked it from my husband's fingers. I have watched it sour in its pots until a mist of green bubbled up for a crust. I have gathered and failed it as the tree for me both ripens and fallows. But now it is perhaps too soon for fruit. The winter this year was hard, the air full of smokes, and do I know if spring reached the valley in time? Who planted this tree? How long has it stood here? How many more years can such a thing remain? My neighbor reaches a hand up into the branches, palm-cupped, weighing the leaf knots. She is looking to see what instincts, what weathers still grow here. She snakes her hand through the greening branches. Up from the valley come the golden tongues of bells.
How did that tree fare the last storm?
Not well.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. I'm a little afraid. I don't think I'm going to get any fruit this year. So back to the farmer's market.
Yeah. I want to ask about The Cry. It's a difficult poem to read. It's about that visceral sound of agony. Mm-hmm. It's about the last grunt, as you put it, of a fish, the cry of a rabbit, the death throes of a fox, and of course a man crying all night. Where did that come from?
Well, it's a family personal story. My husband's mother recently had a very long spell of depression. She herself tried to commit suicide, and so part of this had to do with this incredible sense of terror and vulnerability I think all of us were feeling, and the ways that one cry sort of moves through another person so that everyone ends up sharing in a kind of grief. The good news is she's much better now. She's, you know, doing very, very well. But at the time, I mean, it was a story of watching somebody else go through intense pain. And of course, we all watch people go through intense grief and pain at different parts of our lives and the ways in which we all sort of take part in that. So in my poem, one cry turns into another cry, turns into another cry. Yeah.
It's so spare and so raw. Is this a characteristic, do you think, of the way you want to write? Why you strip away and just reveal what seems like the kind of bleakest? Do you know what I mean?
I do know what you mean. And I laugh because part of – and I shouldn't laugh. It's such a dark thing to laugh at. But I find that as a poet, I'm termed – what they would call a maximalist, which is, you know, you take a long poem and you stuff even more into it. Yeah. And but there are certain poems that really do try to get very spare, to try to get to the heart, so the iron heart of things. And that is one poem. Another one is The Wolves, mm-hmm. watching my grandmother commit euthanasia. Yeah. And you want to get the facts as close to it as possible. And in that sense, poetic language is something to work against. As a poet, I both love my art, but I'm also very distrustful of the things that my art can make people do and feel, which is I can make people feel a lot of things that aren't necessarily true. And there's an ethical component to that, which I'm never terribly comfortable with. And with something that is extremely personal, both to me or to somebody I love, I want to try to get a sense of a larger truthfulness, if not perfect accuracy. And so in that sense, I do want to pare back.
Do you mind reading that one as well?
Sure. The Cry. A man can cry all night, your back shaking against me as your mother sleeps, hooked to the drip to clear her kidneys from their muck of sleeping pills. Each one white as the snapper's belly, I once watched a man gut by the ice bins in his truck, its last bubbling grunt cleaved in two with a knife. The way my uncle's rabbit growled in its cage, screamed, so like a child that when I woke the night a fox chewed through the wires to reach it, I thought it was my own voice frozen in the yard. And then the fox, trapped later by a neighbor, which thrashed and barked as did the crows that came for its eyes, the sound of one animal's pain setting off a chain in so many others, until each cry dissolves into the next grown louder. Even if I were blind, I would know night by the noise it made. Our groaning bed, the mewling staircase, drapes that scrape against glass panes behind which stars rise, blue and silent. But not even the stars are silent. Their pale waves keen through space, echoing the dark, the way my father's disappointment sags at my cheek and his brother's angers whiten his temple. And these are your mother's shoulders shaking in my arms tonight, her thin breath that drags at our window where coyotes cry, one calling to the next, their tender throats tipped back to the sky.
When you have read other translations of Ovid, what is it that you saw that you didn't like? One of the things you've said was that you didn't want to create a kitschy remake like you had seen. And there are some that you've encountered.
The translations try to stay as close to Ovid as possible. But Ovid has been translated in many ways over the centuries. Different poets rewrite those myths. And what's kitschy about them is when they try to stay too close to the original.
Yeah.
I find that the closer you try to stay to an original story, the more you just end up making absurd little changes like the, you know, Nike comes in wearing Nike shoes, you know, which is just not the point of the poem.
Yeah.
I really wanted to get to what Ovid was talking about with change. And one of the things that's fascinating to me is that I think a lot of people think that Ovid's The Metamorphoses is all about change as punishment. But in fact, people are changed as rewards. Mm-hmm. People are changed as punishment. People just sometimes become the animal versions of themselves, which is not change but a kind of revelation of character. So there's no—
Like a purer sense of who they are?
Right.
The actual sense of who they are?
Well, Arachne, for example, is changed into a spider. But what is Arachne doing? She's weaving before. So she becomes a sort of distillation of her character. Somebody who is greedy becomes somebody who just eats and eats and eats and eats and eats himself to death, actually. So those are changes that are both punishments, but also, as I said before, revelations of character. And some people don't even change all the way through. There's a character named Io who is taken by Jupiter, and Jupiter, to hide her from his wife, changes her into a cow after he's, you know, had his way with her. But he doesn't change her all the way through. She still remains a girl, but she's trapped inside the body of this cow. And what's horrifying to her is that she knows who she is, but she can't express this. So some changes aren't even complete, and that's played for laughs, but sometimes it's not played for laughs. And when you realize that Ovid himself is changing the very definition of change, that's what I wanted to get to. So things like gods and goddesses and the plot lines of the stories aren't interesting as much as what contemporary events actually speak to that kind of change.
At what point did you start thinking about that it's about sexual violence, so much of which is in there, of course?
Well, it's funny because I was talking to a friend of mine who's another poet. Her name is Kathy Wagner. And when I was telling her what I was doing, she said, "Oh, Ovid, such a rapey poet." And I thought that's not true. But then I thought, you know, I'd been reading these three different translations simultaneously, and it was staring me in the face. And it was funny because I had just written a poem, Philomela, which is one of the central myths about rape and change. And Philomela is raped by her brother-in-law, and to keep her from telling his wife, her sister, he cuts out her tongue. Mm-hmm. She weaves the story of what's happened to her and shows it to her sister. Her sister says, "This is it." They kill basically Philomela's nephew, Itys, and feed him back to Tereus, the man who raped her. It's a violent, horrifying rape.
Yeah.
And it's a violent, horrifying story, but it's all about voicelessness and sexual violence and representation. And I had written my version of the poem, and I wasn't satisfied with it at all, and I couldn't figure out why. And when I sat down and really thought about what my friend had said, I realized that maybe one of the reasons I kept going back and back and back to these stories was that, and especially the ones in which women are changed against their will, was that, you know, many years ago I had also experienced a sexual assault, and I'd never said anything. I'd never told anyone about it. And so I started writing a gloss called Nightingale that says all the things I didn't say in Philomela and breaks apart Ovid and starts to trace out all the ways that Ovid echoes through history and the ways that the Nightingale story works. The Nightingale is what Philomela turns into after she's, you know, committed these horrible acts and had these horrible acts committed upon her. So the Nightingale is a symbol of poetry, but it's also a symbol of sexual violence. And here I was trying to get to both things, and it was staring me in the face, and I just didn't realize it.
It's interesting that you but in the poem, you leave out the mutilation. You leave out her sister. You leave out that, as you say, the metamorphosis. You leave out that change part.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
In my story, my rewriting of Philomela, she doesn't go on any kind of violent rampage. She does what I think is a very common story of sexual assault survivors, is that they don't tell anyone. They hide it. They imagine telling someone. They imagine creating something. And the irony of my rewrite is that she has a cousin who is able to create this retelling of the Persephone myth, also a myth of rape, because it's Hades, the god of the underworld, who steals her and takes her down. And she herself can't express what's happened to her. And so in the end, I wanted to keep out all these different violations because I wanted to just focus in on the real, I guess, traumatic element of Philomela's story, is that she had speech taken from her at one point.
I'm not sure how much you want to talk about this, but you were attacked, as you mentioned before, in 1992 while you were hiking near Loch Ness. And you describe in some detail the attack. And it's this part of it that I wanted to ask you about, if you don't mind. The whole attack is conducted, as you put it, in silence.
Mm-hmm.
Ovid says that it is imagination that makes possible this sudden turn toward violence, which is what you write. And you write that we cannot hear her. We want to, but she exists only in our imagination. talk a little bit about that idea of silence here, and the imagination part, because I think that resonated with me.
There's many ways that worked for me on a very biographical, practical nature. The silence I experienced was because there were three men in the woods that day.
Yeah.
And two men, they were all drunk. Two men walked past me. I didn't know these men. I was literally just sitting there. Two men walked past me, and the third stopped and started talking. And I knew in my mind I should get out, but I didn't want to be rude. I also didn't know where to go. And when he attacked me, I had to be quiet because there were two other guys in the wood. I had no idea if they would turn back, if they would help me, or they would help him.
Yeah.
So that silence was a very real thing. And the imagination in that case was me moving through in extraordinarily precise and quick detail all the possible scenarios that could unfold. And trying to make decisions as fast as I could based on all of the information I was trying to process. And so that's the one way that imagination and voicelessness was working. But one of the things that, again, going back to poetry, there's so many things that get hinted at in poems, or so many ways in which imagination and desire connect together. And you can animate these things so quickly. And that's one of the things that Ovid is talking about, that Tereus is a passionate man. And he sort of imagines all of these scenarios and then fulfills them. And the imagination for me as a writer is something that is both glorious and terrifying, because we can imagine all sorts of things. We can write all sorts of things. And readers coming to this kind of material can feel simultaneously emboldened or changed in some kind of way. So there's an ethical component to writing and the imagination, and I'm always aware of it. And I went back and forth even in the writing of my own experience about how much to tell. And I also felt that not saying it would make other people imagine even more. So yeah. I wasn't sure what to do. So to try to be as concise as possible, but also as fragmentary and as elusive as possible, too, to give myself some privacy.
Yeah. So you began with a psalm. At least this is what you had in mind when you started to structure it. And Pythagorean was where you wanted to end.
Mm-hmm.
Can we say something about that poem finally? As I gather it, it's a man whose mother was an alcoholic and was distant. And you tell about this moment when he, because his mother was an alcoholic and distant, he doesn't want anything to do with alcohol. But then when in his 20s, he goes to this hotel bar to indulge and just drink a lot to see if he might feel some part of his mother's, as you put it, deep, sweet craving for alcohol take root in him. He wanted to know if it's such a sad poem because he learns later, I guess, that she only quits his mother not because she loves him or any sense of empathy or the fact that she'd been a terrible mother, but the doctor said, you have to.
Yeah.
And she was afraid. That was all. And sobriety didn't change her either. It didn't make her any more kind or loving or anything like that. Would you just talk about this poem?
So Pythagorean, it's a party poem in my mind because one story opens up into another. There's a bunch of things that I wanted to achieve in Pythagorean. Pythagoras in Ovid basically says the world is one large creature eating another large creature. And, he uses this as a reason to be a vegetarian. You never know who you're going to be eating, because also our souls just get transferred into different bodies. But I was really struck by that, this idea that the world was one creature devouring another. And of course, the form of the metamorphoses is one story in some ways devours another. You forget where you started. So one story opens into another story in this party. We begin with this young man who's an alcoholic, but also the brutality, I think, that he recognizes ultimately, this sort of brute and indifferent selfishness, as he calls it, about his mother. But to a certain extent, all of the people in that party are recognizing that or playing with it, a kind of selfishness that they use to justify certain behaviors to themselves, you know, to loved ones, and but also, you know, some moments of a kind of reaching for empathy. The young man wants to empathize with his mother. There's a woman in the poem who is simultaneously frustrated by her, you know, husband's flirting with another woman, but also empathetic. You know, she sort of recognizes why he'd be attracted to her.
Yeah.
You know, and the woman he's flirting with is, you know, trying to calm her son down at the same time, you know, by texting him about, you know, don't worry, we'll go on vacation together, at the same time knowing she's never going to do that with her son. So these kind of moments of empathy that get stripped away into some sort of more indifferent and selfish behaviors. That's sort of what the poem to me is about. The world is this place that we're kind of always trying to navigate. You know, it's is the world welcoming? Is the world kind? Or is it really this brutal? And if it is this brutal, how do we become more kind to each other to counteract that?
I have to say, I encountered that sentiment in a lot of the poems, that same idea. That seemed to be a theme maybe for you.
I think it is. It's funny, I didn't want it to be a theme for me, but I think I keep going back to some really essential questions that I don't think can ever be reconciled. And maybe that's why I began with this notion of faith, because there's no intellectual way that we can reconcile how cruel the world is and we are in some ways in the world to each other. And at the same time, believe that we can be more than that. Mm. And in fact, art is one way I believe that we are more than that. By empathizing and imagining other people's experiences, it's not just taking advantage of that, but it's also trying to make other people sympathetic and empathetic and make people feel drawn to each other and protective of each other. So we're always kind of moving back and forth, I think, between these two poles of being. And myself, I want to fall down on the side of kindness and empathy, but I'm always afraid that, in fact, at the heart of it is violence that can never be quelled and stopped.
That's Paisley Rechdahl. She's Utah's poet laureate, and her collection of poetry is called Nightingale. It's due out on May 7th. That week, which is May 6th and 7th, Rechdahl will be performing a commissioned piece for the 150th anniversary of the Transcontinental Railroad at the Salt Lake Acting Company. You can get details about that on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News. We have technical direction from Tim Slover. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.